Right. This morning, my pleasure to introduce Mike White. Mike is an exhibiting Zimbabwe artist, craftsman and teacher. Grew up in southern Zimbabwe, where he would often find ancient paintings on the granite and in the caves. And then he went to study fine art in Natal. Mike currently splits his time between England and Zimbabwe and regularly exhibits here in Harare. A friend of Peter Garley, the prominent archaeologist, Mike has worked with Peter as an illustrator in a number of his publications. So Mike's going to talk about all that this morning, the rock art of Zimbabwe, the fascinating story of Stone Age hunter-gatherers and their paintings. I've got some blurb here to say, but I'm not going to say it because it's Mike's talk, all about the fascinating history of the rock art here. So, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Mike White.
Good morning. Good morning. Is that okay? Thank you all for coming. I see a lot of you possibly from the Historical Society, and I can see some support from the art community, which is great. I'm an artist, and my focus on the paintings is as an artist, but also as an interested person in the history of this country and the paintings. I want to start off by flashing some images in front of you without talking about them a lot, just to expose you and alert you to the images that I will be talking about. So I'm going to go quite quickly through maybe 15 or 20 images. These images were traced from the rocks, from the walls where they were painted, mainly in the this area. Most of them not further than 100 kilometers from Harare, and some of them very close to Harare. So I'm just going to flash these traced paintings. So Garlick traced them and then reproduced them as a whole. Often one sees fragments of them, but he did them in such a way that they became almost murals. Of course, they were painted by a number of artists over an extended period, but I don't want to talk too much about it. I'm just going to flash these images and then I'll start talking about them. So this is the first one. It's from Wedza. This is from Bindura. This is from Guruve. Marondera. Mutoko. Gormonzi, Mazoi, Mazoi again, Mutoko, Bindura. Mazoi, Marondera, Harare, Harare, Bindura, and then Gormonzi. Mazoi, Gormonzi, I don't know, groovy and groovy. Matobo. Mazoi, groovy. Koromonzi. Murewa. Mazoi. Makonde. Mazoi. Makoni. This is a famous one. Details of their painting. Details of the Makoni painting. I think it's Diana's Vow. And Bindura. And Marondera. And I think that's the last one. Okay. So I am a Zimbabwean artist, primarily a painter, and over the years I've worked with several Southern African archaeologists, mainly as an illustrator. In the early 80s, shortly after Zimbabwean independence, I was approached by Dr. Peter Garlick to help rewrite and recreate the ancient history of Zimbabwe. Two books we produced together were Life at Great Zimbabwe and Early Zimbabwe, which is here somewhere. These books were intended to be affordable, easy to read and understand, a people's history, as it were, suitable for a new nation trying to define itself in an African rather than a Eurocentric way. Peter had a detailed vision of the history, but was unable to draw. After a hesitant start, we worked well together on the veranda of his home. Peter had bought the original Borrow's residence on Crow Hill Road. Him peering over my shoulder and directing my drawing in a very precise way. It was a demanding process, the major reconstructions being without precedent. After the books were done and published, we carried on with our lives. Sometime later, I approached Peter to do another book, as we had learned to work so well together, but he was immersed in a new project and felt that he did not need an illustrator. The new project was the Rock Paintings of Zimbabwe, a project that took him 8 years and which involved him visiting sites of the paintings, often hidden in remote hills, and tracing the work himself. Peter was secretive about the work and did not reveal the whereabouts of the paintings for fear that they would be vandalized. In the slow and difficult process of tracing the paintings, he developed a close relationship with the art, as he called it. And I believe the time spent together at the sites, going over the imagery, gave him special insights and a unique understanding of the people and a culture that had long disappeared. The respect I had developed for Peter as an archaeologist and his incredibly detailed, uncompromising attention to detail has always made me want to understand his thoughts on the paintings. This lecture is an attempt to communicate his images and the words in the book, The Hunter's Vision. So this is about The Hunter's Vision. He writes, "There are many thousands of sites with paintings in the granite hills, caves and shelters, and under the overhangs of many scattered boulders in Zimbabwe, most of them still unrecorded. They were created many hundreds and some cases thousands of years ago. I'm just going to speak briefly about the timeline of these, because then we can place ourselves in history. Nicholas Walker, an archaeologist, recovered small specks of granite that had traces of paintings of them. The dates range from 13,000 to 5,000 years ago. Even more surprising, a cave with the most technically and artistically complex of all paintings in Zimbabwe last saw any substantial occupation some 6,000 years ago. Exfoliation is random of granite, it peels like an onion skin, and happens once, or it can happen once every 8,000 to 10,000 years, so the paintings peel off. And this is fascinating. The paintings in Zimbabwe, Peter claimed, were at least 1,000 years old, probably over 2,000 years old. So that we can place that in history when we think about what happened over the last 1,000 years in Zimbabwe. At least 1,000 years old, the date at which changes associated with farming began to affect the region. Of course, hunter-gatherers are never compatible with farmers. So with the movement of the farmers, a campaign of extermination, as shameful as any the world has ever known, took place. Genocide has always been justified by the persecutors, by reducing their victims to subhuman status, unworthy of consideration or respect. Before they became extinct, some San were able to tell something about themselves. Others still clinging to parts of their heritage in the Kalahari have been systematically studied by anthropologists over the last 40 years. Through the work over the last 20 years of David Lewis Williams in South Africa, understanding of San beliefs has brought the paintings there back to life. I want to talk about the environment, just to give you a glimpse of what the landscape may have looked like 1,000, 2,000 years ago before the agriculturalists arrived. Below the granite hills, the plains seem now to lie silent and lifeless, denuded, divided into small holdings, and dotted with villages and people working their fields. But even within the last 100 years, they were home to some of the richest herds of game in varieties and numbers that the world has ever seen. Little more than a century ago, hunters could describe banks black for many miles with herds of elephant and buffalo, or plains covered with herds of every variety of antelope, zebra, wildebeest, giraffe, and ostrich, all easily visible from a single vantage point. The abundance of life is now only preserved in the paintings. Extensive studies, particularly in the Drakensberg in South Africa, were done by a man called Frobenius, a German explorer and ethnologist, one of whose associates was Elizabeth Goodall, who settled in Zimbabwe and produced a particularly beautiful set of watercolor depictions of the Zimbabwean paintings, which will probably never be matched for their skill, care, and accuracy. This is a Goodall painting. They succeed more than any other in giving a sense of the character and quality of the originals. She wrote very little about the paintings. She never analyzed the paintings. Her contribution was a celebration of the art. These are all Goodalls. This is the Dinosaur painting. This is a particularly curious image, which I will try to explain later. This is a map showing the distribution of the paintings around Zimbabwe, which is very curious because, as you all know, that granite exists all over the country, and granite, of course, is what they're painted on. But the paintings don't occur all over Zimbabwe. As you can see from this map, there are concentrations of paintings in the Harare district. I've got a pointer here. So there's a huge concentration of paintings there, and there's quite a lot in the Metopes, and then there's some in the Mashinga area where I come from. So that is curious, the huge concentration. And one wonders why, you know, why did they like that area more than some of the other areas? If you go to Nyanga, of course, you have these massive granite structures, you know, that sort of lend themselves to painting, but there's very few paintings there. I have heard that there is between 8,000 and 10,000 sites where there are paintings in Zimbabwe, which is considerable. It's huge. This wasn't dabbling with paint. This was a huge kind of obsession with painting. Golek mentions techniques that the artist used would may be of interest to the artist. I mean, it is astonishing that the permanency, we talk about permanency as artists, that the paintings are at least 1,000 years old, and some of them, you know, 8,000, even older, that they have lasted so long. And it is because of the care taken by the painters. Apparently they chose the granite surface with care, and they tried to work on surfaces that weren't too exposed to the weather. If you go to Ngomokuriro, you'll notice that there's a huge kind of slab that is eroded at the base, so the rain doesn't get to the bottom of it. It washes down, but it's kind of dry. And then, of course, within caves. For pigments, the artist dug out various ironstones and iron oxides, which were pounded, crushed, and rubbed to a very fine powder. It had to be particularly fine, using pestles and mortars of harder rocks, and these were found at excavations. The smoother this material was, this paste, the more permanent it was. It stained the rocks. And the paints were mixed with binding mediums on stone pallets, maybe using animal fats and blood. Brushes were made from chewed sticks or animal hairs. The delicacy, the uninterrupted lengths of some of the lines, shows incredible technical skill. The fine line on a carefully loaded brush. The basic feature of the art in Zimbabwe is that it is an art primarily of outline. It's a drawing rather than a painting. The painting was often infilled. You will notice when we're looking at the image, when we'll go back to the images, that a system of multiple viewpoints was adopted so that each element of a subject was clearly visible. So this has been called twisted perspective. So for example, you would look at the face in profile, you would look at another part of the animal or the form from another angle just to show every aspect of that animal. So all different perspectives were used. Okay, I'm going to go back to the original images. As I've mentioned, Garlick's method was to find the paintings, then trace them, which was difficult. The paintings often faded, often quite high. Sometimes he would have to work almost upside down. In that process, he was taken to places where the paintings are and where the paintings were painted and where the paintings belong, because of course they can never be removed. In tracing the details of the paintings, he became intimately familiar with the imagery and started to notice patterns and even the identities of different artists. As he traced and looked closely at the work, he tried to understand it. The black and white images in this lecture are examples of the tracings, which you can see are often large and complex compositions with many, many layers painted over long periods of time. He writes, "One cannot read art. One can only explore aspects of it. Undoubtedly, the spirit world and trance dance had an important place in the Zimbabwean art, but they were no means the sole concern of the artists. Many other aspects of life were captured. The Zimbabwean art," he writes, "cannot be interpreted within a single sweeping overall explanation, nor do they illustrate different aspects of shamanism. They address a broader range of concerns and explore almost every aspect of San society and ideology, focusing on nature and actions of every form of potency, rather than just experience of trance." So these words appear, potency and trance. The dominant image amongst the paintings of Zimbabwe, and I'll just go through these paintings, at least numerically, is that of the male hunter. Tall, slender, naked, painted singly or in parties up to 40 very similar figures. His torso is long and generally curved forward, delineated with hard straight lines and showing his broad shoulders, his buttocks are small but well-defined. His penis projects almost horizontally from his body. His legs are sharply divided into thighs and muscular calves. He has small feet with rounded heels and high insteps. Fingers and toes, as well as facial features, nose, mouth, and eyes are seldom visible. His head is often a simple circular or oval shape at the top of a long neck. Men's heads frequently bear elaborate lines hanging down over the back of the neck and various other lines. The hunter carries a simple curved bow that is generally about half his height, but it can sometimes be four times this long. In one hand he holds between 2 and 6 arrows, usually denoted by a single brush stroke. Much more rarely, men are armed with short clubs with heavy heads with which they attack small animals. The women are painted less often. I'm trying to find these are the women. Their bodies are plumper and more rounded, and often their buttocks are larger and their lower backs are more deeply curved than a man's. Their elongated breasts project one above the other. They often wear tasseled aprons and their buttocks and some over their buttocks, and sometimes have a small apron in front, and sometimes the complete skins of small animals hanging over their backs. Many women also carry long sticks and bags which denote the woman's principal activity, digging for roots or water or gathering food. Women are seen in smaller groups that do not move at more than a sedate walk. Sometimes a child might go with them, and sometimes the woman is shown pounding or grinding tuberous shapes between two stones. Women are often shown in camp together with their possessions scattered around them carefully. All people are shown in their prime of life and full health. No one is weak, sick, deformed, old, or adolescent. Children, on the rare occasions that they appear, are shown as miniature adults. The subsidiary activities of daily life are seldom shown. Sleeping, eating, playing, conversing, embracing, feeding children, breaking or moving camp, moving shelters, collecting firewood, preparing fires or cooking food, making or mending clothes, giving birth or tending the sick, or mourning or burying the dead. He mentions all these activities are not shown. Even hunters are rarely shown engaged in the subsidiary activities that go along with these roles: stalking, tracking, attacking or killing, butchering and sharing the spoils. Thus, Garlick believes that this art cannot be constructed as narratives. The apron and capes and large collecting bags and digging sticks in the paintings closely matched the clothes and equipment of the San women today. There is a total absence of any convincing evidence that the painters were familiar with any of the other features of African agricultural pastoral activities. All San seem to have had a great number of dances. Some were little more than children's games. Some were spontaneous and purely for entertainment, while others were more highly disciplined, standardized, and choreographed. Some were vehicles for individual feats of mimicry and acrobatics, or reenacting dramatic events like hunts. Some would be topical, invented by an individual and having temporary popularity. In some communities, women had their own dances from which men were excluded. Some dances, including dances to make rain, were performed by old men. There were dances which were rituals to mark important thresholds in life. Some these took place very rarely, every 5 years or so. The most important dance for all San was and still is the healing or the trance dance. This takes place whenever it was considered necessary, when several bands had congregated closely together, when there are tensions or worries within the community, when it is felt that the people are alienated or sick, or when it feels right. The trance dances can take place very frequently, perhaps every 2 or 3 days, and they involve the whole community. Women gather wood and light a dance fire in an open, clear space in the center of the camp. In the evening, when the dancing starts, they all sit together in close groups, close to the fire, and clap to the rhythm and dance and sing. All can join in the dance, men, women, and children. For longer or shorter periods, participants dance in a line in very close proximity and often physical contact with each other, bending slightly forward and taking short pounding steps as they progress slowly around the fire. As the dance progresses through the night, I'm just trying to find a dance. The atmosphere becomes highly charged. Excitement, tensions, and emotions arise, and the rhythm becomes more intense and compelling, and the dancers' movements more violent. Those fully committed to trancing will dance together, supporting and encouraging each other, and transmitting their rising potency between themselves. A few will then enter trance and stagger, collapse, fall, and lie rigid or limp. All sweat profusely and some bleed from the nose. Others then gather around them, save them from injury, and lead them away from the dance circle. Here, with the spiritual energy of potency fully active, they can begin to heal. They can now see into a patient's body, into the future, into far, far distances, as they diagnose a patient's ills. They will wrap themselves around him and rub him using their blood and sweat, which are not just the symptoms of their trance, but potency itself. So they transmit something of their potency to the patient, which draws the patient's evil and sickness into themselves, and through intimate contact with him, sniffing and sucking at his body. Illness can be physically manifest as small, sharp objects. These they will spit out and expel into the outer darkness, often with outstretched arms and shrieks. Other trances may leave their bodies, become transformed, enter or take on the bodily forms of animals. Particularly lions and birds. In these forms, they may prowl around and guard the camp or travel great distances to gain information about other groups, movements, or game herds, or about centers of ripening edible fruits, or where the rain clouds are gathering. They may enter the spirit world and there encounter spirits of the dead and the gods themselves and struggle with them. They will also assume characteristics of animal species they inhabit with the swiftness of a bird's flight, the strength and ferocity of a lion. They may travel great distances effortlessly to see what is far away in order to protect their communities against all dangers and do battle with evil. These flecks and marks, according to Garlick, indicate potency. And these images, which have in the early days been described as beehives, appear again and again and again. There are the flecks again. As it becomes active in what he calls the gebezi, potency swells, boils over, bursts open, and rises through the channels of the body. It gives the trances power to heal those in any form or social or physical distress, to transform himself and take the form of animals or birds. It enables him to release his spirit and to go forth and gain knowledge of it and influence other communities, animals, rain, and the whole material and spiritual world. The most important representation of potency introduces a complex degree of symbolism to the paintings. These are represented by forms which have been interpreted in many ways. They look like beehives or grain bins. They are much more numerous, colorful, and complex than anything described so far. No one can deny that they seem puzzling, even impenetrable, but these are clearly the most significant set of images in the art of Zimbabwe. Garlick says these forms are sophisticated abstractions of ideas and beliefs about potency. They are mental constructs developed to realize visually, which is largely invisible. He theorizes that the enclosing circle represents the abdominal wall, the spikes are arrows of potency, and the prickly sensations associated with activation of potency. The ovals represent the internal abdominal organs, including the main sources of potency, the liver and the spleen. It is quite curious that the power to heal and this potency comes from within us, from within they perceived the human body. The ordered lines of dots suggest potency latent in the abdomen and its organs. The arrows or bird shapes escape through the orifices, suggesting potency as an active form, boiling, rising, and bursting forth. In many painted panels, flicks around trees cover very large areas, sometimes stretching across entire cave's walls. Garlick believes that the flecks, the clusters of flecks, are depictions of powerful and dangerous potency. The many paintings of large areas of flecks show how artists conceive of potency pervading the entire surroundings, a force hidden from the naked eye, but present everywhere and made visible only through the paintings. Garlick then goes on to talk about the concept of religion and God. And I've put this to a number of people and knowledgeable people in areas of indigenous religion and so on. And they have disputed this, but I think I'll tell you about it anyway. All sands seem to have recognized a single supreme deity. He created all things. He gave people knowledge and their first weapons and equipment. And he is the ultimate source of their potency, and indeed all potency, of which he himself has an overpowering and dangerous amount. He looks like a man, is married, and has children. He walks the earth, invisible to all, but those whose potency is particularly strong and active, engaging in the same activities as men, such as hunting and having all the qualities, emotions, passions, and failings of mankind. He has been guilty of the gravest and most repulsive breaches of morality, including incest and cannibalism. He creates and dispenses evil, sickness, misfortune, and death. San relationships with their deity is continuous, intimate, easy, relaxed, and without reverence. He is loved, despised, and treated with levity. Prayer is simple, informal, and conversational. It may include questioning, cajolery, complaints, reprimands, scolding and cursing, earthly humor and insults, bargains, pleading and persuasion. But those in trance may come close enough to the gods to engage in struggles with them at very high risk to themselves. Besides the supreme god, many San seem to believe to have recognized a second god with her own particular responsibilities. She has even greater failings than the supreme god, and is even more hostile, threatening, evil, and restless. She is usually envisaged as incompetent, ugly, dwarfish, bad-tempered, and morose, and is often characterized as a trickster. The San believe strongly and vividly in the existence of spirits of the dead. They fear them and pray for them to invoke their mercy or sympathy. In people of the early race, in the first world, the difference between all living creatures was obscure. Animals behaved in fully human ways and shared all human virtues and vices, emotions, plots, and plans. Later, God named and distinguished the different species and assigned to each a characteristic and characteristic pattern of behavior and determined their roles in the world. This amounted to a second creation. Thus, the distinction between animals and people, between different species of animals, is neither absolute nor eternal, but part of a historical process. People and animals inhabit a single word regarding equality, respect, interdependence, and cooperation. Hence the feeling people retained of closeness, tenderness, indulgence, and protectiveness towards animals. I'm sure I've talked long and probably too much, but there's a little bit more of interest that I'm coming to. Olsen appeared to have recognized a basic distinction between clawed and hoofed creatures. The hoofed creatures are benign and good, a creature of herds and communal society, harmless and a provider of meat at home in daylight. The eland was a favorite hoofed creature, the epitome of goodness in the natural world. The clawed creatures, represented by the lion, all had the most undesirable human qualities. A solitary and antisocial predator of the night, wandering at a time when everyone was asleep, liable to attack and kill. A lion is even more fearsome because of the disturbing similarities between it and people. Like them, it dislikes eating in exposed situations. It disembowels its prey as soon as it is killed, buries the stomach, and then carries the carcass away to a convenient place to feed. Crocodiles and snakes, for instance, are classified as clawed creatures. The first white explorers were immediately classified as clawed creatures. Animals provided meat, the most desirable of foods, and animals were classified as having red, black, and white meat. The most desirable meat was that the red meat of large game species such as eland and small antelope like the steenbuck and the duiker. Black meat was of its nature considerably less edible and included the wildebeest, the waterbuck, both with tough, lean flesh and also surprisingly the very palatable and fat meat of the warthog. The fox and the jackal were also black meat. White meat was inedible and repulsive, particularly when it was of creatures who ate human flesh, like the hyena, the lion, crocodiles. Snakes and surprisingly hares also have white meat. The classification of meat is not only concerned with edibility, but with potency. Red meat contains much potency and is appropriate to use in rituals such as a boy's first kill. Black meat has less potency and is only used in a ritual if there is no red meat available. The elephant, which in Zimbabwe is possibly the most revered of all animals, has all three types of meat in it and hence is considered to have remarkable potency. A strong, if not entirely rigid, process of selection determined what animals were painted and how they were painted. Paintings of kudu dominate. Sesame and, to a lesser extent, sable and zebra are well represented, all of them considered red meat by the San. Many creatures were seldom, if ever, painted. There are extremely few paintings of eland, waterbuck, reedbuck, impala, or wildebeest. In the Drakensberg, the eland was the most painted and the most loved animals by man and God, even the most significant in terms of trancing. In Zimbabwe, although the kudu cow is very revered, the elephant takes the place of the Drakensberg eland. The elephant is loved, powerful, and significant. And often, the outline of the elephant covers an entire mural. The elephant is possibly a symbol of trance. The elephant is often painted in outline over whole painted scenes. The elephant is all-encompassing. To a lesser extent, the rhino and the buffalo hold similar status. When animals are painted upside down, Garlick supposes these animals correspond to humans in trance. Trances turn into animals. Animals can become humans. Sometimes there are paintings of people transforming into animals and depicted half animal and half human. Garlick ends by saying that the art was not all about trance, that the culture of the San is open, transparent, understood, participated in, practiced, and legible to all. Some paintings display refined conceptual mastery, some delight in aesthetics, some show delicate craftsmanship, and some are sketchy beginner's work. He ends by saying, in every aspect of the art, we can be sure that we are in the presence of an artistic tradition that was highly developed and sophisticated, which brought significance to a vanished society. And he ends by saying, it's time we explore it further. Thank you. just want to end by saying one thing. God, it was important to Garlick that the paintings were considered and recognized as art. And he goes on to define art as the power to transform, to create new realities, to offer new possibilities, to create responses, to confound, and to do things that otherwise cannot be done. Which is significant to us artists, I suppose.
Okay.
Testing.
Testing. Now we got those. So there's plenty of time for questions.
Question.
So the roving mic will take questions for anybody that wants now. There we go.
What is the most unusual image that has been found in rock paintings in Zimbabwe?
The most unusual? I don't know. The rarest.
The most unusual have been rock paintings found in Tibet and China that seem to represent spacemen. The same in some rock art in Europe. And I wondered if there was anything in Zimbabwe that has caused controversy and debate.
I can't answer that. I have been... Last night I was sent some images that I'd never seen before, and they were described as similar to the paintings, but they were described as Romans wearing shorts. And then there were other paintings that also, they were painted in white, that seemed to me terribly unusual. Almost out of context, yeah, with the rest of the paintings we've looked at.
Question. What's the age of the oldest painting that's in Zimbabwe?
The oldest painting it's quite a difficult question, that, because, I mean, how far back did these paintings go? The rock exfoliated once every 10,000 years. It was clearly a tradition that had been around for a long time. We're in the region of the cradle of mankind. We're in the district of the first of the humanoid species. I've heard that in the Bulawayo district there are paintings that have been dated at 30,000 years.
Am I allowed to supplement a little bit? Because there was this question of the oldest picture. I have just finished this week 6 year work on 32 caves together with the National Museum of Zimbabwe. And it covers 7,000 pictures. And not in contrast, I have nothing to add to the presentation of Garlick, but my approach is a little bit different and may supplement the fantastic presentation by Mr. White. I had taken the pictures, not as a picture, but to establish a sequence of the ancient sand, late sand, and early Bantu. Is it possible using modern software called D-Stretch. D-Stretch does not fabricate. D-Stretch go into areas you cannot see with the eye, and it takes very weak, very, very small grains of color and put them forward. So it's possible, and I'm sure you can agree, behind all these ones were structures, and behind these structures were even weaker structures, which one cannot see with the eye. So I took that huge amount, as far as it describes a tableau, which is beings with a relation in between. And the most ancient then shows systematically huge animals and humans, which is not physically described, but just as a line and clapping the hand up. So the animal, which is, I interpret as a spirit animal, the tableau shows the real thing is the animal, elephants, rhinos, and others, very huge, dominating the entire space, and just a line of human. So I do not disagree one second with Garlock's central thesis that this expresses potency and the transcendence and shamanism, but if I took at each level, the expression of this is different. It starts with a huge animal, and the human is only formed in relation there. The second phase of the sand is where Garlock excels, and he puts fantastic pictures, but which express the potency, the shamanism, in its full extent, covering a long period where it is still an expression, in my interpretation, of the core element of entering into contact with the spirit animal. So we have the human, which is then, in this period, already more described as a human with a full figure. And then the last phase, even under the sand, the spirit animal disappears in the drawing. And you only have a description of the transcendence, the possession. And in the last pictures before the early Bantu comes, you see an even further development. They describe as in Dengeni, humans crawling up to a big human form where they try to relate to his upper arm, and they crawl out for his leg, walking. So going up, they crawl in the traditional Zen trance form, and they come out from his bottom, and it's a huge figure in Dengeni. And we have the same structure in the last part before the early Bantu come. Then with the early Bantu, they typically overpaint core elements of the sand, which shows that a new sheriff is in town. I stop with the early Bantu, but it is a supplement to what Mr. White has said. This is 218 pages, 147 pictures, mainly in D-stretch, which shows pictures behind these ones. And the intention is not to show a picture, which there is covered by artistic work. It is to see the development in a sequence. There are a lot of other things, and I would like to come another day and make a fuller presentation. It's just because there was this question of the most ancient picture, so I believe I have something to contribute there.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
What is the big book called, Jan?
cradle of Zimbabwe.
The cradle of Zimbabwe.
This is actually also George who takes the person. I can just send it around.
Can I just ask what's been done to protect this rock art throughout the country, given the rapid urbanisation? And I speak about Msasa industrial area, for example. There were paintings on those rocky outcrops in that Msasa industrial area. And when people have developed their stands and put up warehouses, they've blasted the rocks, and that's been the end of those paintings. And what's been done to conscientize the population about these?
Garlick's view was that secrecy was the only way to protect the paintings. The paintings are very vulnerable. They're not being protected. There aren't sufficient funds that I know of that protects them. They're subject to vandalism. They're also subject to scraping away the paint to be used as medicine. Also, the rocks are being used as black granite, irrespective of the fact that they've got paintings on them or not. So they are terribly vulnerable. Yeah.
May I ask how many of these paintings have been dated by carbon dating, the pigments that were used over the country?
I seem to remember somewhere in the Garlick book he speaks about carbon wasn't present in the pigments. Yeah. Whether that's out-of-date information or not.
Well, that doesn't sound really right, because if they were using blood or using fat, there certainly would be carbon in it.
Yeah. Okay.
Carbon dating works when you have pure carbon. There is now a technique which measures the radioactivity of the rocks given their composition, and that is now the latest method of dating.
My response to that is, it's not really the rock that we're dating, it's the pigments that we use to paint. But certainly the answer over there is quite correct. There are much more modern methods of dating of various substances that could be used and possibly should be now used.
Thanks, Charles. Question over there. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Sorry, okay. Is that right? Thank you. That's a very interesting talk, but I've got a query about the timing, the aging of some of these paintings, because one of the paintings you showed showed an unmistakable horse. It didn't look like a zebra. It didn't look like a donkey. It was definitely a horse. And I'm told that in the Drakensberg, there are paintings, or at least one painting, which shows people in European clothes on horseback. So it must have been much more recent than 1,000 years ago.
So according to Garlick, the South African paintings are much more recent and much less complex than our paintings. And they might even record settlers.
I'm coming to you now.
Right. One question about the question, how many people were involved. Has there any statistics been proved how many people were related to each painting or group or cave, and how many people that populated Zimbabwe? Or are we just mysterious about the whole thing, about the number of people?
I haven't seen mention of the number of people involved. There are some of the paintings, there's quite a lot of people. I mean, one of them talks about five families gathered. I'm not sure how many people there were in Zimbabwe at the peak of their time.
One other question is, each group of paintings, is there a time period between, i.e. is there three or four different periods for a group of paintings?
Yes. The paintings were painted in layers and painted on top of paintings. And just carried on. I mean, you have to understand, I suppose, that we're looking at a period where there was no paper, there was no written word,
there was no writing.
I mean, they must have been so enormously powerful as images, and they were intended to communicate. They're full of symbolism and metaphor and convention as well. Things were painted in similar ways, that they were communicating a great deal of information, that a lot of which is lost to us, and maybe we will find in time.
Yeah, it's just interesting to see what period it actually covered, because, you know, in Kariba we've had things dug up. They were running smelting pots, smelting iron and making things out of iron and copper, and we've never found out who done it. It's there. You know, nobody's investigated. It seems that there's a big gap in knowledge.
Thank you.
Thank you. You mentioned just now convention, and I've just been thinking that you talk about a period from 35,000 years to recent. And yet there seems to have been consistent styles right through that. For example, we always see all the legs, we always see all the arms, all the ears, all the breasts, and so on. It's almost as though the style of art hasn't changed that much over that really long period. You compare that to how art has changed in Europe, for example. It's almost as though there were rules set up that said, this is how you will paint.
There do seem to be conventions. I mean, Golek speaks about... he speaks about egalitarian society. The San Society was very tolerant and very equal, and everybody was allowed to take part in the dance and in the activities and even in the paintings. He speaks about looking at paintings that were possibly done by children and paintings that were done by very sophisticated, talented artists. So there is, I mean, we look at the animals, they are beautifully described and beautifully painted. And there is a degree of, different degrees of skill amongst the artists. Whether there was progress, there has been talk of various styles and periods of the paintings, and people have tried to extract paintings and say this was an early style and this was a middle style and this was a later style, and there may well be.
Okay, folks, one more question here. Time is drawing on, but please take the question.
Last one for Patricia.
Actually, it's not a question, but I'm aware of an expedition by the French 2 years ago in Matopos National Park to actually document all the caves that were in the national parks in terms of rock paintings, but I haven't seen the outcome.
Okay, folks, I'm sure the discussion can carry on after the formalities of here, and please, you're welcome to stay and discuss. Yes, I'd like to ask Charles Wagon now to come and just thank the speaker.
Well, once again, thank you all for coming. we have a good selection of speakers and subjects, so we can look forward to an interesting and varied and active year ahead. Thank you. But thanks, of course, to Mike, who is raising awareness of this fascinating subject, which, of course, is ever open to interpretation, which contributes to its fascination. But thanks, Mike, for coming. I hope you continue to stimulate the artistic community, perhaps to incorporate some of this culture, but also to stimulate interest in and activity in preserving this rich cultural heritage, which, of course, is one of the functions of the society. So thank you once again, Mike, if I may present you with a very small token of appreciation from the society.
Thank you. Oh, wonderful, lovely, thank you.